It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the recent U.S. intelligence reports about the potential origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. First, the Biden administration is proposing a rule that would change asylum policy as it currently stands. Right now, under something called Title 42, a health law invoked because of the pandemic, immigration laws are being effectively overridden to turn away many asylum seekers under the theory that they could possibly increase a public health risk. With the COVID public health emergency ending on May 11th of this year, Title 42 border enforcement would end along with it. That raises questions about the number of people who could seek asylum. The Biden administration announced a proposed rule last month, which some critics say shows similarities to Trump-era immigration policy and angered some of the president's fellow Democrats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about current asylum policy at the U.S. border? Do you think it's fair or not? Do you think changes are needed? Do you want to see those come from the Biden administration, or do you want to see Congress tackle these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dara Lind is a senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. Dara, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. Good to be on.
I want to take this one step at a time. Take away Title 42, ignore for the moment this proposal from the Biden administration, and what would normal, quote unquote, asylum policy look like at the southern border?
Great place to start. And thank you so much for explaining Title 42 so well so that I don't have to. But under, you know, written immigration law, if you are apprehended by a Border Patrol agent, or if you turn yourself in either to Border Patrol or at a port of entry, like an official border crossing, and you say that you fear persecution in your home country, then you have kind of officially like started the asylum process. You have kind of you have invoked your right to seek asylum in the United States. And that means that if you have crossed illegally, or if you don't have a visa, so wouldn't otherwise be able to get into the U.S., you have to pass a screening interview, which is called a credible fear interview, with an asylum officer, which can take a few weeks, or you can just get released with a court date to eventually see an immigration judge, which is something that they do pretty frequently when there are too many people crossing for them to all get screened. So you initially don't have legal status per se in the United States. You don't have anything permanent. What you have is a pending court date and, you know, the ability to, after a certain amount of time, work in the United States while that court date is pending. And then ultimately you will be put in front of a judge to actually make your case that you've been persecuted based on your race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group.
Now, Title 42, long story short, this is a health law that's been used to say, no, we don't need to do any of the things you just said. I'm summarizing a lot there, Dara. That expires now. Now, we've got this Biden administration proposed rule that would, in effect, do what? What is the administration proposing here?
So the rule kind of creates this new process with a much higher and more convoluted series of bars. So for one thing, in theory, you would be unaffected by this. You would still be able to kind of seek asylum through the traditional route if you presented at a port of entry and had an appointment. Now, they've rolled out this app called CBP1 that's being used for some appointments right now to get exceptions under Title 42. I'm happy to answer some questions about the app, but like suffice to say, it is essentially being beta tested on asylum seekers, right? It's still very glitchy. There are still a lot of problems. It's wildly under available in terms of appointment slots for demand. So a lot of people even now can't get appointments, and it's only going to get worse once this is the only way to legally get asylum. So if you can't get an appointment via the app and you decide to cross into the US illegally, and you are a single adult or a family, you will have to demonstrate that you basically like that your life was imminently in danger in order to kind of qualify for normal asylum procedures. Under most cases, you're essentially going to be held to a higher standard in your screening interview. The technical term here is reasonable fear instead of credible fear. It's something that's usually used for people who don't qualify for asylum for like criminal history reasons or something like that. And it entitles you to a lesser form of protection than asylum, where you still can't be deported back to your home country, but you don't get the ability to have permanent status in the US. You can't have family members come join you, et cetera. So the way to get out of any of this would be that if you had demonstrated that you had applied for asylum in another country before arriving in the United States, and you got rejected. And that's really what the Biden administration is banking on here. They're saying it's not a ban on asylum, period. It's an encouragement of using other countries' asylum systems, or barring that, using the legal ports of entry in the US. They're not, you know, outright posing a ban on asylum for people who cross between ports of entry, because U.S. law straight up does not allow them to do that. It says explicitly that you have the right to asylum no matter where you cross. So instead, they've just created these series of bars that apply only if you cross between ports of entry, while there's this huge crunch, you know, and not everyone who tries to apply at a port of entry is getting served.
I think one of the arguments to do something like this, Dara, is, okay, Title 42 is going to end. We've already seen in the last year or so a lot of people seeking asylum despite the existence of Title 42. The concern that there's pent-up demand, and in fact, we're going to see more people than the asylum system can realistically handle. So we got to do, I guess, something to respond to this change. I mean, that premise, do you think that's valid?
I mean, I think that it's absolutely reasonable to be concerned about the U.S. immigration system's capacity to handle what comes next after Title 42, given that, as you said, like, even when people had no chance of getting asylum, if they crossed between ports of entry because of Title 42, they were still trying in, you know, numbers we haven't seen since before 9/11. But the question about capacity is really, like, is the problem that too many people are crossing and getting caught, or is the problem that too few people are getting deported, or is the problem that too many people end up kind of stuck in limbo and, you know, passing the first screening but not passing their ultimate asylum claims? Or is the problem that a lot of people are getting released from custody and dumped on the streets and don't have anywhere to go because they don't have family members in the US? Like, all of those are plausible concerns you can have with the capacity of the system, but they're very different concerns. And so the Biden administration is banking on the idea that if they make it harder for somebody to get released from custody quickly because, you know, they're presumed ineligible, and they, you know, make it harder for somebody to pass their initial screening interview, that word is going to get back to people's home countries, and people who would otherwise start crossing are going to get the message, don't come. Now, there are real questions about how well that works, because we've seen in the past that, you know, even under Title 42, where there's literally no way to get asylum, we're still seeing a lot of people coming. But it's also an assumption that, like, if it isn't proven correct, they don't actually help anything at all. They're just putting more people into a now more convoluted system, which is going to further tax those resources.
We're talking to Dara Lind, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council, looking at a proposed rule from the Biden administration that would change how people can seek asylum in the United States as a health policy called Title 42 will stop being in effect at the border in May. At least that's the current plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this proposal from the Biden administration? What would you like to see happen with asylum? What questions do you have for our guest? It's convoluted. There's a lot going on here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues. Coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dara Lind with the American Immigration Council, looking at the Biden administration's proposed changes to immigration and asylum policy as Title 42, a health law that's been used to prevent people having asylum hearings at the border. That's going to stop being used at the end of the public health emergency in May. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think we should do what they do in other countries. My sister moved to Colombia some years back in order to achieve a higher standard of living. And they, like most countries, including probably Mexico and most of them, you have to prove that you can support yourself, so you won't be a burden on an already economically stressed population.
Jim, I gotcha. Thanks for that call. Now, Dara, as I understand it, some kinds of immigration, non-asylum immigration, that could be a requirement. Asylum, I think, works differently. Can you tackle Jim's idea there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually want to start with Colombia because it's really interesting to bring that up as a data point. Colombia has had millions of asylum seekers from Venezuela for the last several years. They're taking way more as a percentage of their population than the US is, because it's a neighboring country that kind of couldn't, you know, there's a certain extent to which they couldn't do otherwise. But it's a good reminder that the US is in a really fortunate position that it even can, you know, control things like this, and that it is not, you know, that be like other countries doesn't actually mean be more restrictive in a lot of ways. But yeah, asylum and refugee status are purely humanitarian forms of relief. They're created in the aftermath of the Holocaust on the understanding that sometimes people really were at, you know, in mortal peril from their own governments because of who they were. And so it's been, you know, it's been kind of the one aspect of the US immigration system as it gets increasingly arcane. And, you know, as legal immigration has gotten very slow in past years, that really adheres to the kind of Lady Liberty ethos, right? Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. So that's kind of bedrock in US law. You can't depend on economic support. What's interesting is that what the Biden administration has done at the same time that it's proposed this new rule is it's rolled out an expanded parole program for people from a few countries who had been putting a lot of asylum claims, including Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. And that parole program allows people to come, like, buy an airplane ticket, fly into the US and work legally for 2 years and go and presumably go home. That's not based on an asylum claim at all. You don't have to prove anything about, you know, being persecuted, but you do have to have a family member or another sponsor in the US who can demonstrate that they can support you for the 2 years that you're here, even though you theoretically have the ability to work legally. So it's very interesting that what the Biden administration is saying is, like, an alternative lawful pathway for asylum seekers is something that requires that kind of financial independence.
Jim, thanks for that call. Brian joins us next in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi. So I had a question about, like, the larger political context. When it comes to anything immigration related, obviously, it becomes a hotly debated subject. But at the same time, we're having across the country, like, a huge shortage of workers for low paying and low skilled jobs. It seems like expanding immigration would be a good answer to that economically. And asylum seekers in particular seems like the obvious place to start. So I just don't understand, I guess, why this ends up being so convoluted and why making it trickier seems to be something that Democrats and Republicans both agree on, even though their rhetoric around it is a little different.
Brian, thanks for the call. Dara, what do you think?
So there's a kind of structural problem with American immigration policy that Congress is supposed to be responsible for setting legal immigration levels, and then the executive branch is supposed to be responsible for, like, enforcing those laws, which includes, you know, doing a lot of figuring out how people who come to the US without papers should be treated, since those people have, you know, broken the rule and are subject to federal immigration proceedings. But so what you end up having is, because Congress has not taken any action on immigration of note in this century, a situation where a lot of policy gets made through the executive branch. And because it includes a lot of people crossing the border without authorization, it gets turned into this question of border security, of crime, the assumption that people must be sneaking in for nefarious purposes, a lot of that. And so the idea of people as, you know, potential workers rather than potential threats is just pretty far from the way that, you know, the entire border bureaucracy is set up for enforcement. There's a separate benefits agency that in theory doesn't do any of this. So there's definitely a case to be made that there is, you know, an obvious demand and an obvious supply, and those two things should go together. But, you know, for exactly the reasons that I just laid out, like, talking about asylum as potentially a way to recruit workers into the U.S. is just, like, it's so far afield from the actual purpose of the program that it is a little bit weird to, you know, to even acknowledge that there is something there. The other thing I'd point out is that even though asylum seekers are theoretically legal or eligible for work permits after they file their applications, those work permit applications go through that benefits agency I mentioned, USCIS, which is totally swamped, has been totally swamped since before COVID, and it's only gotten worse from there. And so they are waiting just months and months and months for those work permits for which they are legally eligible.
Brian, thanks for that call. And just our last minute, Dara, I keep hearing about different parts of the immigration system, the one you just mentioned, the benefit system, the immigration courts, the list goes on, being overwhelmed and understaffed. Is anybody in Congress and the White House talking about trying to boost the numbers there?
Well, USCIS is an unusual case because Congress has made the decision that immigrant user fees should pay for that agency. And so while there's been a little bit of support over the last couple of years because the situation has just gotten so bad, in general, that is supposed to be a fee-funded agency. And so when it does fall behind, it only gets worse because you can't spend any more than the amount of applications you have coming in. So that is just a problem that absent a total about face from Congress that's going to cost a lot more money in the U.S. budget can't really be fixed to a satisfactory degree.
And other agencies, including the immigration courts?
I mean, there have been proposals. There actually has been really aggressive hiring of immigration judges, both under the previous administration and this one. But it's really, there are just so many cases coming in that the backlog is getting all the worse. And you ultimately have to choose between, you know, really strict rules that make it difficult to postpone cases if you don't have a lawyer or if you haven't finished your application yet, that can kind of abrogate people's due process. And this inefficiency where, you know, if you have any potential delay in a case, you will take it because you're worried that if it comes to the end, you will ultimately get deported.
Dara, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dara Lynn, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. She joined us to talk about the Biden administration's proposed immigration policy that would change the process to seek asylum in the U.S. after the end of the COVID public health emergency coming up in May. Now, hundreds of book and magazine titles are banned inside Wisconsin prisons. That includes pornographic magazines and books that describe techniques for making weapons or illegal drugs. But the banned books list is also far-reaching enough to prohibit manuals on computer coding. And some advocates say the restrictions make it harder for people to expand their education while behind bars. Sarah Lear reports.
Marianne Olson spent more than 5 years behind bars in Wisconsin. While she was there, she says she asked for books to try and keep up with her prior career field of web design.
My incarceration was to help me understand not only why I made the poor choice I made, but to learn a better way. And in my mind, that meant a strong vocation.
But Olson, who had a job driving a van for the prison where she was incarcerated, says her access to those books was denied.
Here I am being handed keys to a vehicle and allowed to leave every day. And yet a book that would teach me how to use Microsoft Front Page was a security risk.
Prison officials screen inmates' mail and other reading materials. Wisconsin Public Radio used a public records request to obtain a list of the publications that have been approved or denied. The list shows officials used a policy banning anything deemed a threat to security to bar access to multiple computer literacy books. That includes titles like Coding Made Simple and Microsoft 10 in Easy Steps. Even so, the Department of Corrections says certain tech-related books could be allowed if they're part of a course an inmate's taking. A spokesman for the agency says the prison system has expanded its job skills and educational opportunities. But Moira Marquis doubts the logic behind many of the department's restrictions. She leads a prison writing program through an anti-censorship organization called PEN America.
The stated rationale, I think, is that people are going to develop into computer hackers and hack the, computerized systems of security at the facilities, which is a pretty far-fetched paranoid fantasy when it comes to a book like Windows 10.
Marquis believes concerns about security can snowball into banning a wide range of books that are considered subversive.
it's, I think, unlikely that security is really being served by limiting what people can read.
Wisconsin prison officials prohibited scores of books because they contained nudity or were deemed pornographic. A book describing how to fund a cannabis business is banned because prison leaders say it advocates breaking state law. So is one on rope knotting techniques, which officials say could be used to escape. The restrictions also extend into the realm of fantasy. In 2005, a Wisconsin inmate sued after his Dungeons & Dragons books and magazines were confiscated. That suit was dismissed after a prison captain argued the game could foster gang activity and encourage escapist fantasies. But prison reform activist Dante Cottingham says books, whether escapist or not, are a lifeline to people behind bars. He argues book bans are about imprisoning minds.
There's a deep sense of oppression inside prisons. That's simply another part of their oppressive intent to prevent you from growing, from feeling empowered.
Cottingham was released from Wisconsin prison last year. One thing he's enjoyed since getting out? Buying books that used to be banned. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
To browse the full list of banned books and magazines, check out the online version of this story at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we trace the origins of COVID-19 as much as we're able, plus the latest U.S. intelligence assessments, some pointing toward a natural transition, others saying that the pandemic may be the result of a leak from a Chinese government-controlled lab. We'll get the latest news and talk to a Wisconsin researcher. I'm Rob Ferret. You can follow these stories all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Either way, you can stream live this network, our classical music networks, and more, and check out our very extensive archives. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is it time to make the U.S. House of Representatives bigger? The number of representatives has stayed the same for a century while the population keeps growing. A new bill aims to change that. We'll check out the pros and cons of the idea. Now, newly released assessments from the U.S. Department of Energy and the FBI have found some degree of likelihood that the COVID-19 pandemic was the result of a leak from a Chinese lab. This is FBI Director Christopher Wray Tuesday speaking on Fox News.
The FBI has for quite some time now assessed that the origins of the pandemic are most likely a potential lab incident in Wuhan.
But hang on, four other U.S. intelligence agencies reportedly still think the evidence points to a natural start to the pandemic, while two others remain undecided on the source. Most assessments have a low degree of confidence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important do you think it is to find out how the pandemic got started? What questions or concerns do you have about the politics over the argument over how it got started? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Engber is senior editor at The Atlantic. Daniel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, you wrote a piece, "The Lab Leak Will Haunt Us Forever," is the headline. Can you explain what you mean by that?
What I mean by that, unfortunately, is that this is not something that's going to be resolved anytime soon. As you mentioned in your introduction, this intelligence assessment from eight different intelligence agencies plus the National Intelligence Council, I mean, this is, a year and a half after it was first conducted, and we're still in a state of very low confidence. So only one of those intelligence elements was willing to say something with, quote, moderate confidence. That was the FBI. But all the rest either said, we just have no idea, or we are making a low confidence judgment. So I think in light of that, and in light of the fact that, you know, no real substantive further studies of this question are being done, basically due to China's unwillingness to participate, I just think we're going to be in the state of uncertainty for the foreseeable future.
The Department of Energy statement, or actually not a statement, it was kind of leaked in effect, their conclusion. The FBI statements have gotten a lot of attention with people saying, aha, lab leak. Can you talk about, though, who is saying and what they're saying about the natural transmission concept?
Right. So, yeah, sure. This leaked update to the Department of Energy's assessment that came out over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal had the scoop. So the Department of Energy originally is that we just don't know. We looked into it. We can't tell. There's not enough information here. They've since updated that for reasons that are unclear. That has not been leaked. We don't know what new intelligence there was or new reasoning was used, but they've now switched over to saying with low confidence that some kind of laboratory accident might have been responsible. I should just clarify again that all of these intelligence agencies agree that this was not a Chinese bioweapon.
Right.
The idea that's on the table is more that, you know, this is potentially an experiment that went wrong. This was a virus harvested from a bat cave that, you know, ended up infecting someone in the lab who then spread it to the community, something along those lines, not a, you know, a biological weapon. In any case, you know, this is still, even though with the Department of Energy sort of changing its vote, as it were, to low confidence lab leak, there's still four agencies that say, no, this is, you know, probably the conventional story for pandemic pathogens. And even for the first SARS pandemic in 2003, this is something that spread in the wild from one animal to another to humans and then was spread, you know, likely from a marketplace. So that idea, if you just go by the numbers from this intelligence assessment, it's still, you know, five of these agencies said it's probably a market origin. And now two have gone the other direction. And you could just compare it. I mean, there's news, a similar kind of assessment was done of Havana syndrome, the idea that State Department employees were targeted by a Russian energy weapon. And so I'm bringing this up just because the news just came out that yesterday, I think, that the assessment from the seven intelligence agencies came back and one of them couldn't decide and six of them said, this is definitely not a Russian energy weapon. So I think that's a useful contrast. I noticed it yesterday. Like, that's a case where the intelligence assessment is pretty uniform, versus and pretty high confidence compared to this COVID origins thing, where it's just kind of like, most of them say it's probably the market, but a couple don't and no one really knows.
Talking to Daniel Engber for The Atlantic, he wrote about the latest findings on the possible origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Daniel, I think one thing everybody agrees on, at least everybody outside the borders of China, is China could do a lot more when it comes to transparency to help get to the bottom of these things. How much is that hindering assessments like this?
I mean, it's just hindering it enormously. I would say fatally hindering it. In order to resolve this stuff, so the incredible work has been done already. Mike Warraby and colleagues have published a series of papers making a very compelling case for this market origin. They've shown, at the very least, that the first major outbreak was at that market. Most of the early cases were either people who visited the market or who lived in the vicinity of the market. So, you know, that's generally agreed upon. We just don't know for absolute certain that the first infection was at that market or the beginning of the outbreak in Wuhan. So there has been really useful work that has advanced the story. It's not like no progress has been made. Evidence has mounted for the market origin, for example, and there have been drips and drabs of information about the kind of research that was happening at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is thought to be one of the places that may have spawned a putative lab leak. On the other hand, to really get to the bottom of it, well, you'd want to have access to whatever testing was done on animals that were sold at the Huanan market in Wuhan. You'd want to have more complete audits of the various labs in Wuhan that were doing research on bat coronaviruses. There's a bunch of things you'd want to have. Now, the World Health Organization made a plan to follow up on its original formal inquiry into COVID origins and return to China and do some of this work. And this, you know, China has now refused. And so I understand that there are still some kind of attempted negotiations here, but it does not seem likely that this is going to happen anytime soon. The issue has become so politicized. You know, some Chinese scientists have point the finger in the other direction and say, oh, well, maybe this is came from frozen foods, frozen fish that originated in the West. So at this point, on the international scale, it has become such a political hot potato that it just seems very unlikely that this kind of research that would be helpful is going to be done anytime soon.
And you write that whichever side people lean to, there's a big coincidence that they say has to be explained away. If you like the, you know, the natural transmission, people can say, well, wait, this Wuhan lab just happened to be researching similar stuff. If you go for lab leak, wait, this market just happened to have all these animals where the first transmissions happened. How big a deal is the coincidence that's going to be there, whichever answer ends up being right?
I mean, I really think it comes down to people's inclinations on what to believe are really, I found in my reporting and even just conversations with friends and family about this. It's just what sort of coincidence are you drawn to? For some people, you just can't get past the fact that here's this lab with this, you know, this researcher who's known for studying these bat coronaviruses, who's known for studying the very type of a pathogen that led to this outbreak. And lo and behold, of all the cities in the world for this thing to break out, it's, you know, some miles from that lab. How could that be a coincidence? And then on the other hand, this market, as you said, this is a place that was known to have been selling wild animals as recently as 2019. This is a place where people who have visited it in, you know, the recent pre-pandemic past had the thought, this is the kind of place where a pandemic could start. This is exactly the way in which the first SARS pandemic is thought to have started. What are the odds if this really came from a, you know, research lab? What are the odds that things would play out so that it would look so much like the first SARS pandemic, or it would look so much like what you would expect from a natural, what they call zoonotic transmission from an animal, you know, outside of a lab. So I, you know, those are sort of unresolvable. I don't want to pretend that those are, that one can't have a reasonable discussion of the evidence on both sides. I mean, certainly you could add in the fact that almost every pandemic we know of started the same way, not from a lab leak. So even if you just applied that as your, you know, your first filter, well, let's go with what you would most expect based on history, known history, right? If you have these two coincidences, that would push you towards the one that fits with everything you would have expected prior to, you know, 2020. By identifying the two coincidences, I don't mean to say that they're necessarily on equal footing mm-hmm. as a matter of like which is more likely, but I do think it's, you know, the human mind is drawn to this kind of reasoning, and whichever thing turns out to be the truth, there is still one mega coincidence that we just have to make peace with.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Engber is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He joined us with the latest look at what we know about the origins of COVID-19. Up next, we'll talk to UW-Madison professor of pathology and lab medicine about what we still have to learn, what we may never know, how we track the progress of viruses like this in the first place. You can join in with your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about COVID-19, its origins, and dueling national intelligence assessments as to whether it came from natural transmission from an animal or from some kind of mistake at a lab in China. You can join in as we talk to a UW researcher who's been following the disease from the early days. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Dave O'Connor is a UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the challenges of trying to figure out where a disease like COVID-19 started?
Daniel did an outstanding job in summarizing this in the previous segment, but I think I would just add to it that you're operating in a fog of war very early on in a pandemic. There's not complete information. And as he mentioned, we probably will never get complete information out of China. That makes it very difficult to draw firm conclusions. I think that scientists are swayed by data, and we have more data in favor of the natural origin in the market. Whereas the lab leak has some information in favor of it, but it's largely circumstantial and a lot of the information seems to be classified. So it's harder to assess because we just don't know as much about it.
Is this an important question to answer in your mind?
Well, I think it's important because we have to learn from history and we have to learn from our mistakes and we have to be better prepared next time. And if we don't try to get a firm understanding of what happened at the source this time, we'll be poorly prepared next time.
When it comes to labs, even if it turns out this wasn't a lab leak incident, are there things you'd hope we could look at and say, okay, well, in future, we don't want that to happen. Here are things we could do to even heighten our already high levels of caution at places that research potentially dangerous diseases?
I think the possibility that the lab leak is still a possibility at this stage means that as scientists, we need to do some self-reflection. We need to ask what research that's done in the name of pandemic preparedness itself carries risk and what sort of regulations need to be in place to minimize that risk. As David Wallace Wells noted in the New York Times this week, there's still a shockingly low level of coordinated regulation around the world on research that brings in bats or monkeys and tries to understand the viruses that infect them. And without that kind of regulation, it's difficult to know all the work that's being done. And there are some holes in those regulations, like they apply only to federally funded research that could reasonably be closed to make the work that does get done safer and more transparent.
Now, early in the COVID pandemic, you and some of your colleagues, I believe, were doing genetic research to track strains of the disease as they emerged and to see where they're spreading and how. I mean, can we do a genetic family tree and hopefully trace back the origin of a disease like this?
Well, and that's exactly what we have for the market origin. If this were CSI Wuhan, we have a pattern in that previous outbreaks started the same way. We have crime scene photos and that we have mammals in the market that could have housed the virus. And we have the DNA evidence. We have SARS-CoV-2 genetic material from environmental swabs that were taken at the market. That's why a lot of scientists believe that the natural origin is the most likely, is because we have exactly that kind of data from the market. And we have an enigmatic research program in a nearby lab where there might well be data, but it's not publicly available. Scientists can't scrutinize it. And I would hope that eventually that data will become more widely available so that the quality of the evidence could be compared and weighed against the quality of the natural origin evidence.
Talking to Dave O'Connor, professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the difficult search for the ultimate origin of COVID-19, the virus that causes it. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. And I'll point out two things quickly relating to China. There's a sad point in their propaganda because not only were they blaming frozen food at one point, but they also decided to blame a military base in Maryland for as the supposed origin of COVID at one point. And I'm pretty sure the spread of COVID is not traced from there, even inside the U.S. But the sad point I was going to get to is there was a doctor by the name of Li Wenliang, I'm probably saying that wrong, who actually discovered COVID early on when he was treating patients for it, and he died, but he had been told by the police officials in that province to basically keep his mouth shut when he tried raising an alarm about it. And there are two articles in the BBC about this. The doctor who died was in a 2020 article called Coronavirus Kills Chinese Whistleblower Doctor.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. I want to jump in and bring our guest in on that. Nate pointing toward some efforts of the Chinese government that may have obfuscated our ability to track the early days of the spread of COVID.
Well, this is one of the great unknowns about the lab leak theory. And it's an unknown that, coming from Wisconsin, I don't have any particular insight into. But if you do believe in a lab leak theory, you also have to have some blind faith that accompanies many conspiracies, that you have this massive number of people who would have had to have known and who would have had to have remained silent in order for the conspiracy to hold up and for it not to have had a whistleblower leak it. And that's a little bit hard to imagine given the scope, but in an authoritarian government, it has happened before. There was a smallpox outbreak in what's now Kazakhstan in 1971 that was only discovered decades later. So the idea that you could have this kind of large conspiracy that could hold up for years has precedent. And I think if you buy into the idea that there could be a conspiracy that is trying to obfuscate a lab origin, you have to entertain other possibilities. And maybe I just read too much Tom Clancy and Mark Greene, but you could imagine something like a lab leak could also be, people who are involved in that, maybe you plant evidence at a market. I'm not saying that that happens, but once you start considering a conspiracy, you have to be open-minded to the different ways in which that could have manifest itself. And unfortunately, the problem with all of that conspiratorial thinking is there's just no publicly available evidence that we can use to assess its veracity, to assess how the strength of the evidence compares to what we know about the market.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nate. Dave, I'm a layperson. I'm not a scientist. I have no inside knowledge. A couple years ago, if you asked me about the likely origin, my guess would be likely natural transmission, but you can't rule out the lab leak completely. And if you asked me that question today, I think I'd give roughly the same answer. I don't know. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I think we still need more evidence. And I think that there are a lot of scientists, myself included, who are open-minded. I think it's important to restate something that Daniel said at the beginning of the half hour, which is that there is no evidence that this was man-made, that in some way, shape, or form, this virus jumped from animals to people, but from exactly which animals to exactly which people first, is still something that we need to figure out and need more information in order to draw firmer conclusions about.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dave, as I recall, Chinese scientists initially did share a genetic workup of some of the early strains of the virus that causes COVID-19. That's part of what gave a head start to vaccine efforts in the United States. So that kind of cooperation is at least hypothetically possible. Would you hope that the Chinese scientific community would be allowed to open up and cooperate with the rest of the world?
Oh, absolutely. But I think even at the time, the Chinese scientists who did that, that was somewhat controversial within China. And I think that what you're hitting on is the fact that there's always going to be some thumbs on the scale of science. And that's something that we need to work on, not just as scientists, but as part of a global community, because these sorts of viruses are going to emerge in the future. They're going to emerge from different parts of the world in the future. And we have to make sure that we try not to blame the places where the first cases are identified, because that's going to be, frankly, counterproductive. All it's going to do is make countries not want to share this data, when in fact we need as much transparency as possible.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dave O'Connor, UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at what we know and don't know about the start of COVID-19. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a look at some of the latest medical technology, including efforts to use machine learning and so-called artificial intelligence to detect and cure health problems. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. How much would you pay for a football jersey? If you said $1.2 million, well, you probably didn't say that, but someone did. As reported by ESPN, a piece of sports history was auctioned off for just over $1.2 million. It was the jersey worn by quarterback Joe Montana for the San Francisco 49ers when they won the Super Bowl in 1985 and when they won again 4 years later. Yes, he wore the same jersey in both Super Bowls. Hopefully it got washed somewhere in between. Now, I don't have that kind of money to throw around for sports memorabilia, but I do have one that I keep around. When I was a kid, my uncle was working at a restaurant when Detroit Tigers pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich came in. My uncle got an autographed baseball for me. I still keep it by my desk at home. I'm guessing the sale value wouldn't come anywhere close to $1 million, but that's okay. I'm not selling. Sports news you can use. This is Central Time.